You are listening to the Doug Hagmann Radio Show, weekdays 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And now the man behind the mic, a private investigator with over 30 years under his belt, Doug Hagmann.
Good morning, everyone. At 6 a.m. on the West Coast of America, 9 a.m. here in Nice. Welcome to Hagmann. It's the Doug Hagmann Investigative Hour for today, Tuesday, November 6th, 2018. Election day for the midterms. Thanks for joining me this morning. Let me taking an in-depth look at some unfinished investigative business. That's right. Not going to be talking about the midterms. We're going to be talking about that and covering that in later times. They are what they are. Get out and vote, please. Just do that. And look, vote as much as I understand, of course, there's the uniparty, there's the globalist, it's them v. us, it's them versus us, or us versus them, however you want to phrase it. You still have to vote. And the playing field lists Republicans and Democrats and independents. Independents, of course, not having the, in most cases, not having the wherewithal to prevail. So you're left with two choices, R's and D's. In this case, it's my belief that, look, if you don't vote straight Republican in this case, I don't know what to tell you, except that in addition to being a nation divided, we're going to be a nation in big trouble if the Democrats overtake the House, in my view, that is, in my opinion. And I think that a lot of people share that opinion, especially those people with the sense to see what's taking place. But aside from that, we're going to be watching close. The results come in, and of course, I expect to see pretty much what happened in 2016. The mainstream media, the CNNs and MSNBCs and the network, the CBS, ABC, and NBC, they're going to withhold information when it looks bad for the Democrats. They're going to withhold those race results, much like they did in 2016. And what do you say to that? The very same people who will complain, for example, about Sean Hannity from Fox News getting on stage with President Trump and I understand the separation of entities, with respect to the media. I understand that, there are journalists who report the news, and then there are advocacy journalists. Maybe I should spend a minute on this, because this is where we get lumped into the various issues and concerns. I don't think we make any bones about, or I don't think we spread disinformation. I think we're pretty transparent that we are conservative Christians. We advocate for the conservative platform. We advocate for the Constitution. I don't think there's anybody of normal sensibilities out there that would question that. Oh, there are a few, I guess. A few that have cost me a great deal of money, and continue to do so. But aside from that, I think it's pretty clear. We are in the camp of the conservative constitutional supporters of our constitutional republic. And there's no middle ground here. And people... There is a tendency, I think, for people to want to make a middle ground, that they're hoping that there is a gray area that we can work with. I don't think that's the case. And by me saying that, then I have to admit, and I suspect that you're smart enough to understand that, okay, if there's no middle ground, there could be really no discussion about issues. And I'll just give you an example, abortion or infanticide. I suppose we should make sure that we use the proper language, infanticide. Is there a middle ground? You're either pro-life or you're pro-infanticide. There's really no middle ground, is there? Well, I'm pro-life, except when I'm pro-life, but for no. No, you're either pro-life or you're pro-infanticide. In my view, there is no middle ground. There's nothing to talk about. Now, you can discuss, well, when does life begin? In my view, life begins at conception. Plain and simple. It's So what's left to talk about? If I come to the table and I am unwavering in that, fact or in that assertion, what's left to discuss? There is nothing left to discuss. Now, I see the biggest or one of the biggest problems here. I see so many problems. And I really didn't plan on talking about this. I want to talk about some unfinished investigative business that we have to discuss. But just going into this, it's this unwavering ideological divide, because I am not going to waver on my commitment to life. I am not going to waver on my commitment to the Constitution as written by the founders and as intended upon the Republic's founding. I'm not going to waver on that. Are you? I'm not going to waver on the First or Second Amendments or any of the amendments. But obviously, I say that and people are going to say, oh, so you're pro-prohibition. Okay, you know what I'm talking about. And if I have to explain at that level of detail, then I'm not even going to talk to you. All right. I mean, it's just that simple. Get away from me. Is that harsh? Yeah, it's harsh. But harsh times, these are very harsh times. When you've got Saturday Night Live idiots, and I say idiots, meaning idiots, making fun, poking fun at a war veteran with an eye that was taken out in battle. And they think it's funny. Yeah, okay, right? No, I don't think any of that's funny. Look, and I've heard people say, well, you know, I'm pretty... you know, I've got a pretty high tolerance for humor. So do I. So do I. Man, you ought to hear some of the humor here. I mean, it's, you know, I got a pretty high tolerance for humor on both sides. The humor that's used against me. I mean, sometimes I laugh at things. People draw cartoons of me and they make fun of me. And it's fun. I mean, sometimes, look, I own that. I own my mistakes. I own my frailties. I own that. And I admit that. And I laugh at that. I laugh at myself. Sometimes we take life too seriously. But anyway, aside from that, when you start making fun, for example, or making the topic of humor a tragedy, not in good taste. But then again, I look at it and I think, you know, It tells more about the person making the joke or attempting to make the joke than the intended or the recipient of the intended joke. But anyway, there is no middle ground anymore. And I'm not going to cede any ground to anyone who wants to discuss levels of, again, for example, infanticide or discuss gun control, for example. In the definition meaning of the Second Amendment, don't pervert the Second Amendment to suit your political ideology. I'm not going to have that discussion with you. Simple as that. The Second Amendment is there for, and I'm using this as an example in the larger sense here. The Second Amendment is there so the people don't have to fear their government. The people can have the weapons to rise up against a out of control government to put it back in its place. That's the intent of the Second Amendment. Not hunting, not sports. No. It is for the integrity of our nation. Does that bother you? Does that trigger you when I say that? Well, good. Pick up your crayons and your coloring book and your binky and your blanket and just go sit somewhere. Let the adults take care of this. Anyway, how'd I get off on that? It's been a pretty wild morning this morning. If you're getting this broadcast late, that's my fault, all right? There was a series of events this morning that took place. I'm not going to get into it, but voting, I got to go back to vote because, let me tell you, the voting turnout at my polling station, huge, huge. I thought I'd actually kind of take some extra time this morning and get to the studio after voting, but that would have put me way beyond the time I had to map out this program. But anyway, so back to my point, though, about this lack of gray area. And just look, we're having a conversation here. Well, I'm having a conversation. You're listening, I guess. I don't know. Or you're yelling at me and throwing stuff. But here's the thing. And this is where we're at today. You've got a chasm, this big Grand Canyon-esque gap between the red and the blue. Simple as that. And there is no middle ground here. Because, really, when you think about the people on the blue side, the blue wave that people were talking about, the socialist ideology, what, socialist light? Are you okay with that? Are you, well, you know, we'll just have kind of, sort of, socialism. Socialism in just some areas. Or we'll just have Marxism in just some areas. No, no. That's kind of like saying, well, you know, I'm just kind of pregnant. No, you're not. You're either fully pregnant or you're not. So you're either a full-blown socialist and too stupid to understand that you are, and you just regurgitate the old talking points of the old guard, or you're a patriotic nationalist. Yes, I said nationalist. It's not a bad word. You favor the United States. It's kind of like living, it's kind of like your house, okay? You know, for as much as I want to help my neighbor, I've got to help my family first. For as much as I want to give to various charitable causes, I need to make sure that, you know, the mortgage is paid, and I need to make sure that the bills are paid. It's, again, how did I get off on this? But I'm speaking about the rift that exists in our country, the divide that exists in our country right now. And I assert this. President Trump did not create this divide. President Trump did not create it. President Trump is a consequence of that divide. And think about this. You had 8 years of a full-blown Marxist socialist in the form of Barack Hussein Obama, also known as Barry Sotoro. How many presidents, by the way, had really two different names? But of a full-blown globalist in the form of George W. Bush and his father before that, and then the globalist of Clinton. I mean, you get the idea, right? But really, Obama put us on the fast track to socialism, put us on the fast. Obama, but not just Obama, Pelosi and the Democratic Congress, the Congressional Progressive Caucus, the Black Caucus, they put us on the path to socialist during that 8 years in such a blitzkrieg manner that they were the ones that said, you're either with us or against us. You remember that? And payback's a real pain. You know, you remember the word that they used. But they widened, they created and deepened this gap between the right and the left, between the red and the blue. Donald Trump is a consequence of that in office. So he didn't create it. He's firming it up because he too is a man of principle. And he's saying, look, you're either for border security or you're not. There's really no in between. Well, we'll let you know, some people in illegal, or we'll allow some illegal. It's anything less than the law and order that the Constitution in our nation of laws calls for is disorder. It's chaos. And as much as the mainstream media wants to attribute chaos to this particular president, I've got it on good authority from inside sources that there is no chaos. It's just the left. It's the media. It's the media is actually creating the optics of chaos inside our country, inside the White House. There is chaos throughout the country, but it's being stoked not by President Trump. President Trump is beholden to the ideology upon which this country was founded. It's the media who are stirring things up, and I've said this in previous programs. It's the media, the lying members of the corporate Cloward Piven Alinsky media that is really creating the ideological, or furthering the ideological divide here. And it's they've declared war on the conservatives, on the representative republic, on our Constitution. They're the ones out there perverting the Constitution. They're the ones that are out there assailing the rights, our rights, First Amendment and Second Amendment rights. And how's this going to end up? That's what elections are about. And now some people are worried about black box voting or you know, voter fraud. I am too. I don't think that there will be. There always is. There always has been voter fraud, stuffing the ballot boxes, changing votes. I understand that. But I think in this particular case, just knowing what I know from conversations from people within the, actually within DHS, just conversationally, there have been some changes made. So I think that issue of voter fraud is being watched. Some of the loopholes have been closed, or the holes, security holes have been closed. It's interesting because, you know, you do know who the boxes, the Diebold boxes and such, you know, the ownership, the control, but the information I've been getting of late, and I did bring this up, I brought the concern up. During one of many conversations, and they're aware of this. When I say they, I'm talking about members of the Donald Trump administration, and most specifically the enforcement division, upon whose purview it is to make sure that there's integrity in voting. Now, they're not going to get all of it. There's going to be reports, I guarantee you, of election fraud. And if the Democrats should lose, especially in the House right now, or specific key state races, there will be claims, just like 2016, of illegitimate elections. It's, again, you've got to remember 2016. Everybody made a big deal when President Trump says, well, you know, you can accept the results of the election if you lose. Well, I'm going to have to take a look at it at the time. And he didn't say no, but the mainstream media just, you know, had a fit. Well, it's the left that's doing this. They look at President Trump as an illegitimate president. They look at the Supreme Court placements of Kavanaugh and Gorsuch as illegitimate. Well, okay, we had questions about Obama's illegitimacy. And as a matter of fact, through the cold case posse under Sheriff Joe Arpaio and Mark Zullo and Carl Gallops and others, legitimate concerns about the legitimacy of Barack Hussein Obama, also known as Barry Satoro, Bathhouse Barry. And I've seen reports. I've seen the police-sensitive or law enforcement-sensitive reports issued by Sheriff Joe and others. And you've seen the essence of those reports yourselves. If you've watched our shows, our flagship shows, you've seen it too. So if there is any degree of illegitimacy, it would be from Barack Hussein Obama, Barry Satoro, his constitutional eligibility, which, by the way, is still an issue and will come out, I believe, which leads me into the unfinished investigative business that we have. I'll just put a cap on what I was saying earlier, is the ideological divide. That there is no middle ground. I'll take it one step further. You either believe in the God of the Holy Christian Bible. Now, maybe that's not the right. You either believe in God Almighty of the Bible, or you don't. You cannot believe in a watered-down God. You cannot believe in a watered-down or perverted Jesus or gospel or Bible or whatever. You either believe in God as written or you don't. And this is the point I was trying to make last night. The cultural Marxists, via a number of methods, not the least of which is the infusion of immigrants people into our nation who are not, have no intention of assimilating, and who are actually antithetical in ideology to our representative republic and our moral and Judeo-Christian roots. They're busy degrading our culture, our religion, our language from within. And that's the bigger picture here when it comes to the Cloward Piven caravan, okay, as Reagan Babbitt pointed out. It's an attack. It's an attack from within. And I have to say, I have to give props to the enemy. Hey, they're working the crowds, man. They know how to work the crowds to convince you to appeal, because Americans are kind-hearted. We are fast forgiving. We're kind-hearted. We're gracious. We're open, as a rule. So they play on that. They play on our strengths. Those are our strengths, but they turn them into weaknesses. Anyway, I don't know how I got off on that track, but you understand what I'm saying. So today's going to tell the tale as to, and I have a feeling. I'll just tell you what I think. I think that we are going to see some, and I could be wrong. So tomorrow, hey, look, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't have any special knowledge. Here's my feeling. I think that we are going to keep the House by a slim margin. I think that we're going to keep the Senate, of course. That's really a no-brainer. And I think that the Democrats are going to suffer some interesting losses. On the other hand, I see some inroads being made and some ground being taken by the blue, by the Democratic Socialists, because they're becoming more and more aggressive in their approach. They're shedding, just like the advocacy journalism of Fox News, as I mentioned Sean Hannity getting on stage. Okay, that's really not journalism. That's advocacy journalism. But that counters, that's like a counterweight to the advocacy journalism of CNN and MSNBC, in a sense. You've got MSNBC saying, oh my goodness, that's just horrible, that you've got this essentially a state media in the form of Fox News, and specifically Sean Hannity. They're not entirely wrong in that argument. On the other hand, what are they doing? They just do it in a more stealth-like fashion. So, I'm looking at this from an intellectually honest, in my view, opinion, and I'm offering this to you. MSNBC will in my view, and the other networks, what they will do is they will throw out all sorts of news items, claim they're fair, they're covering both sides, but they're pushing the socialist Marxist narrative all the way. And while doing that, they're saying, well, while they're doing that covertly, or at least not in your face, they're complaining that Sean Hannity in Fox News doing it openly, that they're committing the crime. They're committing the ultimate sin. Man, it's, there's no reasoning anymore. There is no reasoning. But there's also, and nor should there be, in my view, any compromising of certain principles. You are either really America first or for the representative republic. You are either an American. You are either allied to our constitutional ideology, our American founding ideology, or you're not. You are either totally pro-life or you're not. You are either pro-First and Second Amendment or you're not. And I feel I've got standing here to talk about the First Amendment, having been censored, banned, and even sued for what I've said, which is still going on, by the people who want to shut us up. It's only going to get worse, though. I wasn't going to say anything about this, but I want to, you know what, I'm going to talk about this just really briefly. There's a case, let me grab this here, again, I wasn't going to talk about this. The Hollywood Reporter brought this up. And I'm going to just toss this out there. Because remember how I said that the censorship issue will affect every one of you? Remember that? And I'm sure you, at some point, I'm sure some of you said, oh, come on. There's no flipping way it's going to affect me. I'm a nobody. I'm really nobody in the scheme of things. I mean, not a nobody, but you know what I mean. I'm not even a blip on anyone's radar. Well, okay, listen to this. MSNBC's Joy Reid is at the center of a free speech legal fight over retweets. Now, the backstory is really simple. It was in late June. Remember President Trump's family separation policy, in air quotes? A viral Twitter post caught the eye of Joy Reid. Now, she's with MSNBC. Now, I'm using the terminology in the article here from a Hollywood Reporter, but an activist, Alan Vargas, tweeted a photo of a woman in a MAGA cap seemingly yelling at a high school student during a city council meeting in California. Now, the woman, Rosalind LaLiberti, was among a crowd that was said to have called the student a dirty Mexican. That's supposedly what it was. And told him, you're going to be the first person deported. Now, this according to Vargas' tweet, the tweet made by Alan Vargas. Well, Vargas wrote in the post, spread this far and wide. So Reid, Joy Reid, clicked the retweet button, and that tweet went out to her 1.2 million followers. The problem with that is the woman, LaLiberti, didn't say those things. It was a week later, after local news coverage of the incident, Reid tweeted an apology to the woman depicted in the tweet, in the image, and the teenager. All right. Well, okay. And the tweet said, I guess it appears I got this wrong. Now think about this. Put yourself in either one of these positions. Well, guess what? LaLiberti filed a defamation case on September 25th against Joy Reid for defamation. And they're requesting punitive damages. Now, again, put your thinking caps on. As Reid's legal team prepares its response, the fight is spotlighting an issue most Twitter users likely have not considered. Yes, it's possible to be liable for defamation simply by retweeting someone else's defamatory statement. Certainly, a retweet is a form of republication. This according to Marvin Putnam. He's an entertainment litigator. All right. Another litigator, Jeremiah Reynolds, says, yeah, that's right. If you tweet about someone and say that, for example, they're racist, or retweet someone else saying it, and you don't have any evidence to back that up, you could be liable for defamation. Oh, new rules here. Okay. Experts right now are split on whether the underlying tweet from activist Vargas is actually defamatory. But that's not even the case. The case is they agree that the simple retweet by this Joy Reid could make her liable for defamation if the court finds that it is defamation, the original tweet. Defamation law has a rule regarding republication that essentially says that a person who repeats defamation is just as liable as the person who originally said it. Yeah. Now, as to the actual contents of Reid's retweet, whether it's defamatory is complicated. Boy, it sure is. Because LaLiberti is likely not a public figure, meaning that she's not subjected to a higher legal standard. But the tweet centers on an issue of national importance, which is immigration. Now, while the people are private figures, the issue is of public concern. Where have I read that before? Cost me a lot of money to read those sentences. Now, obviously, if you don't know it's not true and have no reason to believe it is not true, then it should be fine, as this is a matter of public interest. Because defamation requires actual malice before there can be liability when wrong. But, and also too, Twitter, the hyperbolic chamber. In the Twitter context, courts have seemingly adopted this higher standard for what can be considered defamatory because there's so much inflammatory content anyway. Everyone who reads Twitter, they're expecting hyperbole and inflammatory rhetoric. Anyway. Now, it's interesting because you got another lawyer, Lincoln Bandlow. He says Joy Reid's going to lose. It's possible he's predicting that Joy Reid's going to lose the case on summary judgment. La Liberty's attorney, Lynn Wood, is one of the best plaintiff defamation lawyers in America. The woman the woman is clearly a public or a clearly a private figure, meaning, you get the idea. I'm not going to get too deep into this, but so you have a private figure, which, oh my goodness, and I've seen this, you know, it's interesting how certain public figures want to be public, and then when it's advantageous to them, suddenly they claim they're private figures, and they, you know, delete their social networking accounts, but I digress. Anyway, and try to you know, hide under the guise of being public or private figures. But a verified Twitter user with 1 million-plus followers like Reid is much more likely to be a target because the person probably has more financial resources and because the account has a broader reach. But even some unknown person on Twitter with just a few followers, think yourself. You could be found liable. You could be found liable for defamation by retweeting something. The public doctrine requires just one other person besides the speaker and the subject to hear the statement. There it is. Oh, and the more they hear it, in the case of 1.2 million followers, the bigger the damages. But wait a second. Retweets don't equal endorsements. I love that. I love that. Well, you talk about straddling a fence. Well, just because I retweet something, I don't endorse it. You think you're covering your ass? First of all, you're showing that you don't have any backbone. Oh, yeah, I mean, seriously, I'm not going to retweet something I don't endorse. Unless I add commentary to it, you know, applicable commentary. But interestingly enough, the legal minds are saying that claiming retweets don't equal endorsement in your Twitter bio is not going to offer you much protection. Probably not. Michael Weinstein, an attorney, litigator, said that I don't think you're protected simply because you're not endorsing what the other person says. What you're doing when you retweet is you're advancing a defamatory statement and making it more accessible to the rest of the world. Yeah, well, that's the objective. I mean, when you retweet, what do people think? We've lost all common sense. Watch this case. Watch these cases. And just watch them. And to those people out there as well, who believe that they can, with impunity, make statements, make accusations of real world accusations of us being Russian agents and money launderers and whatever other disgusting and untrue thing. Well, take heed. That's a two-edged sword here. So, yeah, it's in the Hollywood Reporter. It's the title of the article. I'm not even going to link to it. You can find it if you're interested. MSNBC Joy Reid at center of free speech legal fight over retweets. Again, the Hollywood Reporter. You can find it. But I really want to get into the unfinished business of investigations because if, for example, we have if the Republicans lose the House, you're going to have a lot of things being brushed under the carpet. And I want to get into that before, and even before the potential that happens. You might even be saying right now, well, a lot of stuff has been brushed under the carpet. Where are the perp walks for the emails and Benghazi and Uranium One and so on and so forth? Well, if you're upset now, you're going to be even further upset if the Democrats manage to take over the House and keep positions, because you're going to have potentially Pelosi as Speaker and potentially Waters as head of the Finance Committee. I mean, it's going to be a nightmare. It's going to be more than obstruction. It's going to be a flippin' nightmare. And if the Democrats lose, I just wonder what their reaction is going to be. If they lose on the federal level, I just wonder what their reaction is going to be. We can, again, we have to adhere to our standards and our beliefs and our own ideology. In my view, we cannot give an inch. In fact, we're too tolerant and too compromising. We cannot give one inch. Because when, as in their words, they give an inch, we take a 100 miles. I'm paraphrasing, but you know what I mean. So, but what is the business at hand here? You see now, you've seen Grassley and his people with respect to the Kavanaugh hearings. Oh, you lied about the accusations. All right, we're going to make a criminal referral. That, to me, is just one of the, that's one issue that will go away forever if the Democrats retake control of the House. And I think this is important to hold people who make accusations to a standard. I'm talking about specific accusations of, in this case, with respect to Kavanaugh. And shame on them. Oh, yeah, I lied to advance the cause. I took one for the team, basically. Well, you should be taking one then in prison after your conviction, after an investigation. But see, the investigations are just going to go by the wayside if, again, the Democrats take over. But let's take a look at where we're at, kind of get a feeling as to where we're at with respect to the Russian collusion story. Oh, that's kind of gone by the wayside, isn't it now? President Donald Trump and his staff, well, apparently they must be Russian colluders, but we really can't prove it and haven't been able to prove it. Why? Because of the obstructionist or because of the compromised Republicans on the House and such and the leadership there. And so we have to change it. But if we don't change it, well, there's going to be hell to pay. But see, the Russian collusion is kind of this inside joke. I don't know. Isn't that interesting? I've got my office has got a, you probably heard that phone ring. Have you been just deluged by telemarketers? My goodness. And people who sound like they're human, but they're not. I'm telling you, our landline rings, I don't know, 15, 20 times a day with those kind of calls, even though that we're on the no call list. Yeah. Like how I lose it. I've got ADD, follow the shiny trinket there when things happen. But no, I just, because I know that came through the microphone. It was my fault for not putting that on silent, but nonetheless, it's one more time, just one more time, and I'm gonna take the phone, and it's amazing what a 9mm bullet can do to a phone. I'm kidding, okay? Don't send me emails, but let's get to the business at hand here, where we're at, because I think this is important, especially if the Democrats take the House. What's going to happen is you're going to see an empowered, a re-energized Mueller. If they don't, you're going to see some exposure of criminality. And I think that it's going to be the latter. At least I pray that it'll be the latter. And let me explain. If I had to start anywhere in this conversation, and because of the time, let's just go back to Barack Hussein Obama's final day in office, January 20th, 2017, the inauguration day for President Trump. You remember Susan Rice, National Security Advisor to Barry Satorra, sending a classified email documenting a meeting that she had attended 2 weeks before that. You remember that? The meeting that was between her, Obama, Biden, James Comey, and then also Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates. Remember that? It was an email that said, hey, we did everything by the book, right? You remember that? It was as she's being pushed out or walking out the door out of her office, like at 12:15, and then a few minutes after becoming unemployed, after the President Trump was sworn into office, that she sent this email. It was just kind of out of place and strange. All right, let's start there, because that kind of says a whole lot. And that email, it came after a separate briefing by intelligence community leadership on Russian hacking during the 2016 presidential election, according to the email. And in that message, sent minutes after President Trump was sworn in as the 45th president of the United States, Susan Rice apparently wanted to be sure that she had all of her facts straight. So she typed up her recollections of the January 5th meeting with Obama and Biden and Comey and Yates. And she wrote this, and I quote from the email. And it pains me to even use the phrase President Obama, but President Obama began the conversation by stressing his continued commitment to ensuring that every aspect of this issue is handled by the intelligence and law enforcement communities by the book. The president stressed that he's not asking about initiating or instructing anything from a law enforcement perspective. He reiterated that our law enforcement team needs to proceed at its as it normally would by the book. Man, you know, look, you don't have to be Inspector Clouseau or Sherlock Holmes, I guess would be more appropriate, to know that this is, boy, what a CYA move this is. And the email went on to mention discussions from the meeting about whether or not they could or should share certain information with the incoming Donald Trump administration, specifically as it related to the Obama administration's Russian investigations. Who did Susan Rice send this email to? She sent it to herself. Now, emailing yourself, why? Now, do I do that? Yeah, I do. Do you? I'm sure you have. If not, you can understand the reasons for it. But emailing oneself, in generally, in a position like that, that's kind of strange for in that context. Now, you got to understand the context. That's strange in that context. See, especially for someone seeking to do things by the book. Again, I will email myself reminders for appointments or certain things at certain resources, but not an email like that. Why would she reiterate Obama's alleged motives like that? Why document her intent in an 11th hour email to herself? And the email, after some redactions of classified information, continues. The president asked Comey to inform him if anything changes in the next few weeks that should affect how we share classified information with the incoming team. Think back to Farkas, that Farkas interview. You know what I'm talking about? You know what I'm talking about, right? On MSNBC. But anyway, Comey said he would. In other words, Obama asked Comey, hey, let me know if anything changes in the next few weeks that would affect how we share classified information with President Trump and his team. In other words, you've got an incoming presidential team. And the Obama's saying, hey, you know what? Let me know. Keep me posted what we should keep from them. So here's the question. And the question that everyone should be asking, and really the essence, the backbone, or the nugget of what everyone has been talking about now for 2 years. When you consider the reluctance by Obama and the people closest to him to share specific intelligence on Russian election interference, that's telling. In other words, we're not going to. We have this intelligence information, but you know what? We're going to keep it from the incoming administration. Why? Do we believe that they're part of it? Well, look, if Russia had, in fact, hacked anyone in their attempt to influence the 2016 election, and there was absolute proof, conclusive evidence demonstrating that, wouldn't that be a matter of national security to the incoming administration? And they should damn well know about it. Wouldn't they want to be sure that President Trump did something about it here as we sit on Election Day, midterm 2018? Well, and if he didn't, by the way, wouldn't they want to show that they had made their best effort to advise him to do so? Seamus Bruner in his book Compromise makes that argument, as do I. But the email is telling it. It's further revealing in that it names Comey as a point of contact for Obama during the transition. Now, why am I talking about this on Election Day 2018? Because this, they are going to pick up where they left off in 2016. Different people, of course. Same support structure. Comey, Obama, Rice, Yates, Preet Bharara. Oh, the pillars, the pillars of morality, right? Brennan. Did Obama intend for then FBI Director Comey to communicate with him after Donald Trump's inauguration? Can you say shadow government? Say it with me. Shadow government, right? We've had a shadow government in place for the last 2 years. It's being run by Obama and his backers. When I say Obama, look, the guy's a lazy son of a gun, all right? It's the Valerie Jarretts of the of that team. And Obama's just their pretty face, God forbid. But, okay, so was Comey, again, supposed to be Obama's mole in his capacity? Remember, he wasn't fired at that time as FBI director. So you've got Obama living in the shadow of the White House, running a shadow government, Comey as a mole for Obama, perhaps? Comey would, obviously, he was fired in May of 17. So that was, what, 4.5 months later, 5 months later. And he's been accused of leaking classified material. Specifically, why? Specifically to damage President Trump. And after he was fired, he allegedly leaked further details. And I would suspect, as Seamus Bruner does, this was retaliation for the firing. And those materials served to implicate President Trump in obstruction for requesting that he close the Mike Flynn investigation. Oh, man. And it was apparently sometime after President Trump fired Comey on May 9th of 2017, Comey began leaking written memos of his conversations with the president, implying that President Trump may have said untoward things. Again, think about what I'm saying in the context of the midterms here. Not the voting, but what happens if the House falls to a Democratic leadership. This is what's, look, this is where we're at today and why it's a matter of grave concern and should be for every American, every thinking American. Where they're going to pick up is, okay, the Democrats, socialists, and the people who are allied with them, including but not limited to the media, they have actually seized and continue to use Comey's alleged memos, even today, in ways that are not as overt as they were before. And they're drafting articles of impeachment based on the charge of obstruction of justice. The whole mess directly led to Rod Rosenstein's appointment for the special counsel director, former FBI director Robert Mueller. And here we are today. So the future of Robert Mueller does rest on today's vote. the future of Attorney General Jeff Sessions rests on today's vote. The investigations that began in the House and are continuing in the House, at a snail's pace, rests on today's vote. Because once the if the Democrats take over the House, all of this will be gone. Instead, articles of impeachment will be drafted, dusted off, redrafted, refined. The Senator Grassley, House Permanent Select I sometimes get the House and Senate mixed up, but you've got Senator Grassley. He might weather the storm, but on the House side, not so much. Now, right now, to date, aside from Comey's book, we have not seen the memos I referenced earlier. But it's interesting that we've seen, and I'm going to be, well, I'll tell you what, I don't want to get into Comey too much. Comey is what he is. But when you look at his memoir, A Higher Loyalty, Truth, Lies, and Leadership, his memoirs is almost like reading an admission that seeks to justify his actions and those around him throughout the 2016 election. The book is, in my view, filled with mischaracterizations, petty personal attacks on President Trump, calling him slightly orange, short, and other such references. But see, here's where we're at now today. Comey and McCabe, the people central to the 2016 election abuses, I believe guilty, in my opinion, guilty of a number of abuses of power. What are you going to see? You're going to see that brought back into the fold should the Democrats take over. You remember Uranium One? Well, before I move on to that, the FISA abuses, what Dan Bongino talks about, what Sean Hannity talks about ad nauseum, the FISA abuses. We barely scratched the surface on that. Gone, if that happens. And the FBI and the Department of Justice talking about abuses. What about Uranium One? Oh, yeah, that's just, you know, hey, I checked with Snopes, right? Or I checked with PolitiFact. Oh, come on, look. The FBI and Department of Justice could have stopped the Uranium One sale to Russia. They didn't, despite having intimate knowledge of Russian nuclear-related bribery, espionage, racketeering, my goodness, kickbacks, you know, on and on and on, money laundering schemes that directly implicated Rosatom. And Rosatom is the central figure in that as well. Clinton received the lion's share of criticism for allowing the deal to go through. And that's rightfully so, because the Clintons received $145 million from Uranium One investors and failed to disclose or otherwise hid millions of dollars that were donated to them from the chairman of Rosatom. That's right. Where's that going to go? It's going to go out the window. What about the FARA Act, Foreign Agents Registration Act? How many members of the Democratic Socialist Party are actually working on behalf of other interests? And that's what the midterms are about, too. The Foreign Agents Registration Act. Individuals, people associated with the federal representatives, surrounding them. Agents of other governments and abuses of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Look, the FBI and Department of Justice are responsible for investigating and enforcing laws that guard against foreign influence. You want to talk about foreign influence in our elections? Look no further than the Democrats. Look no further than the Democratic Socialists. and the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and the Clintons, and the Obamas. But that's going to go away. And you want to talk about surveillance abuses? Look at Comey. Look at Mueller. Look at Brennan. Look at all of these intelligence luminaries. They have a history, long history of investigative failures. Just pick up License to Lie by Sidney Powell. Comey and Mueller, they've worked together. They've promoted surveillance interests from inside the FBI and outside of the FBI. Comey's net worth skyrocketed over 4,000% after he changed the rules regarding domestic surveillance and reporting and advocating programs to his benefactors' gain. In 1 year alone, Comey received $6.1 million from a single source, and that was Lockheed Martin, the single largest U.S. contractor in history and a major surveillance state player. Now, why am I saying this today? Welcome back. Different faces. In some cases, different faces, but the same tactics. The FISA abuses, we're going to see those resurge again under a Democratic leadership in the House. How about, look, again, I can go on and on and on, but you're going to see these investigations be pushed under the rug. Any advancements made to date on any of these issues you're not going to hear about them again. Benghazi, never again. That's getting old, I know, but don't even think about it. Or certainly, most assuredly, Fast and Furious and the murders of Border Patrol agents, you're not going to hear about that anymore. Now, the immigration itself, you're going to see total obstruction of immigration, rules and laws and procedures. But here's the big thing, in short, in sum and substance, every single piece of investigative product will be laid to waste with a Democratic win, if that does happen, which is why it's so important to get out and vote. And if it doesn't have, if for example, we lose that, if we lose the House, if we lose that investigative power, you're going to see the everyone and me, the censorship, the shutting up of any type of exposure to this man. If I bring up, and I'll tell you this right now, if I bring up Spygate in the context of Obama, Comey, Brennan, the Five Eyes, as I've done before, you watch how the censorship is going to increase. So we will be living under this bubble of Orwellian control. Totalitarian control. We've got to stop this. And I will say this, regardless of how the elections go, we're in for a very bumpy ride. Because once you see what the Democratic Socialists have done, especially during the 8 years of Obama, which is slowly coming out over the last 2 years, is slowly coming out. Once that water drip, that faucet, water faucet, once that's turned off by the Democratic Socialists, should they regain power, there will be an opposing reaction to that I don't think many people want to live through or want to experience, I should say. Because the only other method is a very disturbing one. If there is a return to lawlessness at the federal level and a burying of the federal crimes and a self-enrichment by the Democratic Socialists, I do predict, I'm not in the business of predicting, but I don't think it takes Nostradamus to say that there will be a huge problem. So we wait. We wait until tonight. You're going to choose law and order. You're going to choose openness. Or are you going to choose the quest for authoritarian leadership? Pray, folks, pray. Pray like your future depends on it, because it does. May God bless each and every one of you. Vote, vote, vote.
The Doug Hagman Radio Show is brought to you by The Hagman Report. Tune in to The Hagman Report weekdays, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, go to HagmanReport.com. That's HagmanReport.com.